Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And boy, don't we get around. We're now taking you to Nashville, Tennessee.
Otherwise known as Music City.
Which is?
Music City.
Yeah, but it's the event we want to attend.
Exactly. It's also called Music City Food and Wine Festival. Second time they had it. First time we went there, we had a fine old time. They know how to party in Nashville. And they know how to eat and drink in Nashville, and we did our share.
We did.
But we want to start off.
Although I'm not anxious to get meat in three anymore. Well, that was called instant indigestion.
Okay, well, never mind. The Nashvillians like meat in three.
Right.
So that's what's important. And if you want the best meat in three in Nashville, the place to go is Arnold's, which is where we went. And I can't tell you where it was because somebody drove us and dropped us off there who insisted that we try it out, and he shall be nameless. but let's get in a party mood. These Nashvillians know how to party, and they know how to organize an event, and we always like to acknowledge people who have helped us out a lot. And we became Infinity's friends.
Yes, we
for the duration. They had a really nice tent covered area,
and we homesteaded. With
a bar serving white and red wine, beautiful white leather chairs, and we stationed ourselves there as our base for the entire 2 days of the Nashville Food and Wine Festival. We did some recording there, which you're going to hear. So, Joseph, what's his last name?
It's Joe Sanfilippo. Is the senior manager brand engagement for Infinity, which was a principal sponsor of the event.
And here we are saying thank you. At On the Menu, we always like to say thank you. Thank you for people who have made our job easier. And Joe Sanfilippo, spokesperson for Infinity, has certainly, his company has been an enormous help to us here in Nashville, as they're one of the main sponsors of the Music City Food and Wine Festival. Joe?
It's our pleasure to have you here. We're excited to be part of the Music City Food and Wine Festival this year. It's been a fantastic event for us, and we are happy to have you here in our hospitality tent. Take advantage of the space. We really enjoy being here, and the individuals that are here are from all over the country. Very passionate about, of course, food and the beverage of choice. And it's a great fit for us because these are discerning individuals, and we like to offer them a place to come, relax, and also experience our products while they're here.
And we had a great time. So on behalf of us at On the Menu, Joe, thank you so much for your hospitality.
Thank you.
One of the very special things about the Music City Food and Wine Festival is the way that the local chefs serve up their great stuff, and visiting chefs also serve up great stuff on a different venue.
Well, do they actually? And there are three distinct crews. I mean, you
there were two.
A day of an afternoon of all the local chefs. You had an evening of the national out of town chefs, plus a concert, and then the next day a whole other group of local or regional chefs, I guess you'd say.
So, but we managed to kill two birds with one proverbial stone, because we met up with Mike Latta of Fig and the Ordinary in Charleston, South Carolina, and also with one of the stars in the local restaurant scene, Tandy Wilson of City House. And it turns out they're great friends, which is how we managed to capture them together. And we talked to them about their point of views about the festival. They both had a good time, and they're both really fine chefs whose places you should visit.
Here we are still having a wonderful time in Nashville, Tennessee at the Music City Food and Arts Festival. And we have a new friend chef and an old beloved. Not that you're old, Mike. I'm just saying we've known you for a long time. Let's say hello and talk a little bit to Mike Latta of Charleston, South Carolina, of Fig and the Ordinary, which I have not yet tried. You cooked last night. Tell us what you did.
We did something that we do at the Ordinary. We did a grilled squid appetizer type thing with burnt eggplant puree and paprika vinaigrette. it's hard to decide exactly what you want to showcase in an event where you serve 1,200 people in 2 hours with culinary students as your help. So basically, you just try to figure out what speaks to your cuisine the best, and that is the easiest, most bulletproof recipe. So that was a pretty good one for us.
Actually, we noticed, and Peter and I exchanged comments, you and also Alon Shia were so wonderful with those kids. I mean, the culinary students, telling them what to do, what was expected of them. You have an affinity for this teaching stuff.
You could look at it two different ways. Those kids, when you need something done and they have so little experience, become a very big liability to the operation that night. So if you don't have your business in order, then it's difficult to communicate with them. But if you put yourself in their shoes, what an unbelievable opportunity it is to be one-on-one with a chef that you normally wouldn't meet under a different circumstance. And the way I look at it really is, I want to have a good time. I want them to remember this for a long time. And so we looked at the way they were holding knives. We looked at the way they were approaching the opportunity and how to, like, next time if you get an opportunity, the kind of questions to ask the chef. And, it turned out to be one of the highlights for me that last night.
Tandy Wilson, tell us a little bit about you, because we're new friends.
We are new friends. Yeah, I'm a local chef here in Nashville. I'm a born and raised Nashvillian. Traveled around a little bit. I went to school in Arizona for a year, and then I cooked in wine country for about 3 years in Napa Valley before coming back to the South. And I worked back in town here with a good friend, Margo McCormick, for a while. And then we opened City House, it'll be 7 years ago, in December. So, it's been a fun time. We do Italian food with Southern ingredients. And the menu is certainly driven by what we have around here, our local influence, as much as it would be an Italian influence as well.
What was your dish?
Yesterday we handmade mozzarella. So we made like 60 pounds of mozzarella yesterday morning. And then we had a little bit of we call them stewed peppers, but it's sweet peppers that we marinate with oregano, lemon zest, raw garlic, and then we lightly roast them in the oven. So they're still real juicy and flavorful and fresh with a little bit of cucumber.
Now, Mike, you just did a...
The panel was called Southern Roots, and in that panel was Frank Stitt, Alon Shia, and myself. And basically the question was, you know, you're not from the South, with the exception of Frank. How is the story being woven into your lives and your food? And we just talked about our personal experiences discovering Southern cuisine and our connection to it and how we fit.
I think you really need, although I'm sure it's well known, your two restaurants, the names and the specialties of your two restaurants in Charleston.
So Fig, 13 years ago, was a farm-to-table restaurant. It still is. That's a difficult description to hang your hat on now, because anybody worth their salt is cooking food raised or grown in their community or at least close to it. But it's, ultimately it was designed to be a neighborhood bistro, has a lot of European influence in its technique. But we use local ingredients, and I think at the end of the day it's simple, fresh cuisine, uncomplicated. And at that restaurant, anything with fish or vegetables are what we really, you know, vegetables take the center of the plate more often than not at that restaurant. As where The Ordinary was open because of my growing love for seafood, eating it and cooking it. So that's a distinctively seafood restaurant. And we built the restaurant around the concept of a raw bar. So we have these, you know, like many other raw bars, we have tiered towers of poached and raw shellfish. And I think that's, if you had to get only one thing, strangely enough, when doing research and development for The Ordinary, I searched out the best or the most loved seafood restaurants on the East Coast. And the number of restaurants that popped up for me in that research was alarmingly small. So it seems that there might be some kind of a disconnection with restaurants on the beach or on the coast and being touristy, or the kind of volume that doesn't really align itself with the what people want to eat today. And so I thought there was room for a restaurant in Charleston, my version of a seafood restaurant, with the same mission statement that we have at Fig, which is let's create relationships, let's celebrate those relationships, and let's respect the product and do as little as we can to it so you can enjoy the wild flavors of the ocean in Charleston.
Have you read The Third Plate, Dan Barber's The Third Plate? It's really eye-opening. I'm not sure I understand it altogether, but what he basically is saying, we have a long way to go beyond the farm-to-table stuff.
It's really funny, Mike. We just got back from Friuli in northeastern Italy, where the northern Adriatic yields a lot of what goes on the table. So we had a discussion with the chefs that we met, and we said, you must really count on the suppliers that you have. You have to trust them, because what you're putting in on people's plates and in people's mouths is coming straight out of the sea, sliced maybe, but not adulterated with anything else other than that. And we went back to one restaurant we went to 10 years ago, and the last time we went, they served us 8 crudo courses. And we were not allowed to leave until we had some seafood that was cooked, which is really kind of amazing. Now, there's an amazing cooking adventure going on today, which, Tandy, you're involved in. You're cooking large pieces of animal back there, including lamb. Tell us about lamb.
Yeah, we're cooking with Martin's Barbecue over there, and we did a lamb. It's in an Argentinian style on the crucifix is what, well, that's how it translates anyway. But it's the whole animal, and it's spread out and roasted over coals. We rotate it 2 to 3 times. And lamb is a little different than a pork or pig. You know, you have that subcutaneous fat on the hog and the skin that kind of baste the meat the entire time during roasting, but with the lamb, we use a very simple saline, salt water and grated raw garlic, brush it with that throughout the roast, and it really cooks amazingly fast. In about 3 to 4 hours, you have a delicious lamb. Yeah, it went on about 9 this morning, so 4 hours, I think, was about the time on it. And you know, you get everything you want. You get that crispy crust on all the exterior areas and the belly and the thinner bits, but you get that juicy mid-well lamb. I know mid-well is a temperature we talk about as something that not a whole lot of people like, but on a whole roast like that, it's just a beautiful, juicy, great texture temperature. So really great way to cook and just finishing it with lemon juice. No olive oil, no nothing. It just needs just the bare minimal there.
You've lots and lots of opportunities for food festivals. Why did you select this one?
Tandy. Because of Tandy. We've been trying to get together for like the last 5 years. Nashville's one of the cities that, in my panel, I discussed how I think the South, several years ago, at least my version of it, was all kind of a homogenous character. And over the last several years, each city seems to be breaking out on its own with its own identity. And very few cities in the country have what Nashville has as far as the feel, the vibe, the history, and its connection to music. So that makes it so I kind of look at it from a tourist perspective. If I was traveling from Europe and the States, I would find Nashville to be very fascinating because of, and as far as American history goes, a very important place. So we only do festivals now in cities that inspire us.
Yeah, we actually encountered in a shuttle a couple from Plymouth, England, and it was like it boggled my mind that they would, of all the places come to Nashville. In your own words, everybody tells me the whole culinary scene is exploding in Nashville. One of the things I noticed is that we're not a whole lot of specifically chef-owned restaurants. In your words, explain to me how you perceive the current dining scene in Nashville.
It's certainly in a growth right now. A lot of restaurants opening. The chef-owned and operated restaurants are here. You know, we have Lachlan Table and Rolf and Daughters, ourselves at City House, and there's a slew of them for sure. I think right now we're seeing the bigger format being expressed in some of the restaurants, and that's where we see, you know, investors coming together to create a breathtaking, beautiful restaurant. So, a lot of that is happening right now, but yeah, there is a growth trend all around for sure. I think that the chefs are still out there. They're still owning, they're still operating, They just might not bring home all the press right now.
Well, thank you both for talking to us and for cooking up such great food for us. And I hope to see you soon, Tandy, and hope to see you and Mike in Charleston.
It's a pleasure as always. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having me.
We should note right here that City House is a starting player for the Tennessee Titans. Now, he's wearing number one, and he's not very tall, so my guess is he might be a kicker. And we'll be back right after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Next up, we hit the booze. I must say that the food level, the high quality was just so pronounced in food, but also in booze. In fact, I think there are probably more booze brand representatives than chefs.
There were actually approximately twice as many. But there was beer, there was wine. Most of the wine was not from Tennessee. There was lots of liquor, most of which was from Tennessee, and really a lot of very interesting changes going on in the whole booze business in a state which used to be unique in the fact that it had three counties where you could distill liquor, and all of them were dry, all of them were non-alcohol states.
You couldn't sell yourself there.
So the history of alcohol production and consumption has been rather different in Tennessee, and there's another wave happening right now because craft brewing is catching on and craft distilling is catching on, and we caught up with the head of a company called Jackalope and the spokesperson.
I love their logo.
Yeah, the Jackalope.
Jackrabbit with antlers.
Yeah, and Matt, is it Wilkinson, who was an ambassador for Corsair, which makes more kinds of booze than you can poke a stick at, all within the shadow of the Davidson County Courthouse in Nashville, Tennessee. So we engaged them. They were good friends anyway, and we engaged them in a very interesting conversation. There's something significant about sitting under a tent in the shadow of the Davidson County, Tennessee Courthouse, because laws related to alcohol beverages in Davidson County, Tennessee, and the state of Tennessee as a whole have been rather different over the years. So we found two recent experts in making product and being able to sell it legally. So across the table from me, Bailey Spaulding, who actually hails from Vermont, but has now become a Nashvillian or a Davidson Countyan, and Will Atkinson, who's the ambassador for Corsair Distillery, based right here in Davidson County. How have things been able to change in the way they have, Will?
Fortunately, things have changed for the better. For quite some time, there were only three counties in Tennessee in which you could legally distill, and they were all dry counties. That changed in February of 2010 with the passing of the micro-distillery law. As of that passing, there were 46 counties where you can now legally distill, 47 once Hamilton County, Chattanooga, got their act together. So now we're able to make alcohol here. And at the Corsair Distillery, we are the first legal distillery in Nashville and Davidson County since Prohibition, and to my research, even before Prohibition.
Well, we'll come back and talk about it, because you have a rather wide range of product. But we can't leave Bailey out here, because Bailey was headed for an entirely different professional career. So, okay, Bailey, I'm going to ask you a number of difficult questions, but let's start with the first one. Why did you quit lawyering to become a brewmaster?
Yeah, I graduated from Vanderbilt Law School in 2009, and while I was in law school, I started homebrewing and come from a place where we have the most breweries per capita, so I have a very strong part in my heart for craft beer already, and I had a science background before law school, so when I started homebrewing in law school, I realized that it really is a science experiment, but with beer at the end of it, so much better than all of the other science experiments I'd done before. So when I started homebrewing, I realized how much I loved brewing beer, and the craft of it. And so when I graduated law school, realized that if I didn't do it, I would regret it for the rest of my life if I didn't try. So, I passed the bar and had a legal fellowship during the day and would write our business plan at night for about 6 months. And then,
I want you to explain the name of your company, the inspiration for the name, and the logo.
Sure. So the name of our company is Jackalope Brewing Company, and, I grew up an avid, believer in jackalopes, which are a mythical, creature, but real in my heart. It's a half jackrabbit, half antelope. So friends had, it'd become a joke about me, and friends had given me a t-shirt with a jackalope on it that said, believe in yourself. So I was graduating law school and everybody thought I was crazy, because I was going to start a brewery. It was like, believe in yourself. So now all of our beers are named after folklore characters or mythical creatures or legends. So it's a lot of fun.
Corsair itself is a very elegant brand. Lots of black and white and very stylish, beautiful containers and a huge range of product for a small business. Tell us more about that.
Well, as far as the name goes, you have a Corsair and a Privateer, both of which were pirates licensed by the French and British government, respectively. They were doing something normally illegal, piracy, but giving a large cut of what they stole to their respective governments. Gentlemen pirates are licensed pirates. We are doing something that would normally be illegal, making alcohol, but I'll say we're giving more than our fair share of cut to the federal government, so it's legal, and it's a gentleman pirate connection. And Corsair just has a better ring to it than Privateer, although some of us would rather be associated with the Empire over the French, but that's just me.
Tell us about all these different versions of alcohol beverage that you make, because it's not just a one-trick pony.
So we do a number of different things. We do a vapor basket gin, which is a similar manufacturing process to Hendrick's gin, but we use significantly more citrus peel than they do. So our gin is kind of like an Americanized Hendrick's. They are heavier on the cucumber, and we are heavier on the citrus peel. And that is what got us on the map in the first place, because that particular gin won us a gold medal at the World Spirits Convention in San Francisco in 2009. And after that, we've done a number of different other spirits. Our most popular is Triple Smoke, which is an American single malt whiskey made of peat, cherrywood, and beechwood smoked malted barley. And that was rated Artisan Whiskey of the Year from Whiskey Advocate Magazine for 2013, which is a UK publication. So we're pretty proud of that accolade.
Now, you bring in these ingredients. I asked you, do you bring in something liquid to blend? And you said, absolutely not. Now, we take it all the way from the raw material.
We do. We do grain to glass. A lot of consumers would be surprised at how many labels on store shelves are from distilleries that don't own a still. To me, not only is that blasphemy, but that is heresy. And what we do is grain to glass. Everything we do, all of our whiskeys are, you can come to our facility, you can see us lugging around bags of grain from Scotland, from Germany, from the United States, making the whiskey that you see.
Now we're in Tennessee, as we mentioned earlier on. So, of course, a question listeners around the world are going to have in mind is, how can I lay my hands on some of this stuff? Perhaps I just can't, and I'll have to come to Nashville or thereabouts. Maybe your product from Corsair is more widely available. Tell us about that on a website where people can get more information.
Sure. People can get information for Jackalope. Our website's jackalopebrew.com, and we have all the information on our tap room and our beers and you know, different events we have going on. Unfortunately for most of the world, our beer is only distributed in Tennessee, almost entirely in Middle Tennessee and a little bit in Chattanooga and Clarksville as well. So we're expanding, but slowly.
The breweries that I've been following are really getting into these heritage grains. Do you experiment with grains like that?
We do some. There isn't a lot of the grain that we need grown in Tennessee, but we're starting to try to work with some farmers to see if we can get that done. We try to experiment with as many kind of unique local ingredients as we can. We've started growing some of our own hops. We do beers with local honey, locally roasted coffee, thyme, beets, all kinds of kind of weird things that we have fun with. We're in the process of installing a small batch system at our brewery right now so we can do more of those, you know, one keg at a time, really unique experimental brews.
And how about Corsair?
As far as our availability, our spirits are available in 26 U.S. states and 4 EU countries. One of the most popular in the EU is the Whiskey Exchange in London. That's a store that we've been carried in for quite some time. The gentleman claims to have the greatest selection of whiskeys in the world, which included even buying from us after our first year of being open. So you can find our Triple Smoke Whiskey, our American Single Malt, over the pond in London.
Well, that's fantastic. It's an absolutely fascinating story. Did you have something to add, Lynn?
Let's have a wonderful brewer here add a sentence or two.
Oh, sure. I can talk about our growth a little bit as well, that we actually, the brewery, we opened in 2011, and we've actually tripled in size in the past 3 years, but every time we get more fermenters and we think we're going to expand more geographically, Nashville grows. You know, it's a pretty unique thing to be in a boomtown and in a city that is growing this rapidly. So new bars and restaurants keep opening. So every time we're like, oh, this is going to get us to Memphis, it just keeps getting consumed in Nashville, which is, to me, is a great thing. We could just keep growing and keep the beer as local as possible. That's would make me happy.
So there you have it, listeners. Even if you don't like country music, there's a good reason, at least two good reasons, to come to Davidson County in Nashville, Tennessee. Thank you so much, both of you, for talking to us. And I'm sure your business is going to continue to flourish and to grow. And I see no obstacle unless we have another 18th Amendment. Wouldn't that be a terrible thing? So raise your glasses, ladies and gentlemen, around this table to the 21st Amendment, the most important amendment in the years of the U.S. Constitution.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Next up, I'm so glad we saw this place, Acme Feed.
Acme Feed and Seed.
Is like, it's a venue that offers something for absolutely everybody, an entertainment venue. You can even do yoga on the roof.
It's an unbelievable space with the sushi Nazi is going to be.
He's on the second floor.
On the second floor.
And they have event spaces.
It's just a remarkable establishment. And let me give you a clue as to how busy this place is. They give you a number when you come in so that the servers can find you with their food. We arrived early. We left quickly because we had a plane to catch. They were serving numbers in the 170 range.
Yeah.
Before 12:30 in the afternoon.
Yeah.
So this is not only a fascinating redevelopment, it also looks like a real gold mine.
Yeah, and it's a thank you to historical structures because it's beautifully preserved. I'm sure it was not cheap to do that, and it wasn't simple.
I'm sure not.
But it is gorgeously preserved.
And suitable to Nashville, Matt Farley, who's the executive chef over this restaurant and some others in the same group, he's also a musician.
Yes.
So we spent quite a bit of time talking about all aspects of life in Nashville, which, of course, in many cases surround music more than they do food.
Well, we're at Acme Feed and Seed, which is actually a restaurant. It used to be a feed company. And we're going to be talking to Matt Farley, who's the executive chef, although he's also a musician, so I'm not sure. Matt, are we going to talk or are you going to sing?
No, I think we'll talk.
Yeah, this place is charming. Can you just give us our listeners a brief explanation of all that went into this rescuing an historic structure?
Yeah, this was a feed and seed store for, I think, almost 50 years. And it closed in the mid-90s, and it sat here for 20 years. And the owner was a gentleman named Tom Morales. And he used to come here as a kid and buy their hog feed and their chicken feed. And they had something where you could bring your dog and dip it in this liquid to get the fleas off it. So he has fond memories of this building. And when all the restoration started, he wanted to leave as much of it alone as he could and use, repurpose all the wood that we had to move for elevator shafts and stairways. And it's multi-floor. There's four floors with a rooftop and three floors for business. It was a huge undertaking. It took, they worked on it for 6 or 8 months, and it took a whole bunch of hands and engineering and figuring out how we're going to do all this. But it's a pretty special place.
Well, I mean, I think it's charming, and it just gets, I mean, it's just perfect for Nashville. Anyhow, now you, strangely enough, are not from Nashville. Tell us a little bit about that. Where are you from, and how did you get a southern accent?
Do I have a southern accent? You know, when I talk to my brother, I'm from New York, and when I talk to him up there, he already says, I think you're getting an accent already. I'm from New York. I'm from upstate New York originally and moved to New York City early, mid-90s. And I went to the French Culinary Institute, and I had worked in restaurants a long time before I went to school, around in some restaurants there, and became the executive chef at the NoHo Star, which is these days becoming a little bit of an institution. It's been there for mid-80s, I believe, 84 or 85. And from what I understand, still going strong. And I have a bunch of... I'm a musician, too, and I've played music for way longer than I've been a cook. And I was living in New York. I had a bunch of my friends that lived here in Nashville, all touring musicians and songwriters, and some of them in management, the artist management. And they were all of them saying, you need to come down here and just visit and see what the city's about. You know, why are you up there shoveling snow and trying to, you know, obviously you have your career, but you're trying to play music, and it's really difficult to do it in New York, as is most things that you try to do in New York. Which, you know, it's the greatest city for me, one of the greatest cities in the world, but very difficult place to live. And anyway, I came down here to make a record, and it was in April, and I remember it was still cold up there, and it was gorgeous here like it is today, maybe a little cooler, but gorgeous, beautiful blue, sunny skies. And I went right home and told my wife, I said, we were ready to move away from the city, but we didn't know where we were going to go. And I was like, we need to take a trip to Nashville and just take a look at the town, and we'll, you know, I can work anywhere, really, in some capacity in a restaurant. I had enough experience. I thought that I could get a job line cooking if I had to. It's so much cheaper to live here too. So we took a trip as a family, and she fell in love with it too. So that was 5 years ago, and we haven't looked back. I absolutely love the city, and so does my family.
In fact, you got all your other family, the rest of your family, to move here too. You're a good salesman as well, huh? You also are involved with two other restaurants by the same owner. Tell me about those.
The Acme Feed and Seed is the newest of the three restaurants. There's a restaurant in Franklin, Tennessee called Sapphire, and it's been there about 15 years, which I've only recently been put over that kitchen as well. I was hired to open the Southern Steak and Oyster, which is on 3rd and DeMumbrian right here in downtown Nashville. And I was hired actually 2 years before it opened, and the flood happened and pushed everything back. And so the company that I work for is Tomcat's Hospitality Group, and he has a lot of irons in the fire. We cater movies all over the world, movies that we've all seen, Lord of the Rings, all those kind of movies, big movies. Yeah, and we work in Atlanta on The Walking Dead, and we do a bunch of television shows, Ugly Betty, 30 Rock, all those. And we have crews in New York that work as well. Right now we're doing a couple shows in Virginia. I believe that's where the boss is this week. So I just worked around the company. I worked at Sapphire a little bit, and at the time we had a couple other properties that we were managing, one of them being the Loveless Cafe. I worked out there at the barn. I didn't work in the cafe. I actually worked in the catering barn that's out behind it. So I was just kind of in a holding pattern waiting for the Southern to open. And then finally, 2.5 years later, it opened, and it's been open the floodgates. It's been a runaway train. That restaurant is so busy, and it has been crazy, crazy busy from the very beginning.
I'm sorry that I missed that. And everybody told me I also had to go to Loveless Cafe, and I missed that. Spend most of your time here at Acme Feed and Seed. And this is not very, hasn't been around very long because we got invited to the opening, and of course we couldn't come because we were in Pittsburgh. But do you spend most of your time here?
At the present time, I do, yes, because we're, as you just said, relatively new, I think a month and a half, 2 months. Once the dust settles, I have a chef de cuisine that works here, and he has a sous, and then there's the bunch of cooks. And then at the Southern, there's a chef de cuisine and I think 4 sous chefs or 5 sous chefs, I believe. And there's 40 back of the house people at the Southern. It's a very big kitchen. So at the moment, yes, I'm spending more time here. But after the dust settles and we get this place, all the floors open and full throttle, I'll probably split my time. I'll spend 2 days here, 2 days at the Southern and 1 day down in Franklin at Sapphire.
Well, you know, I'm torn here. I would think since you're a musician that you probably have special playlists at these restaurants. Or do you just give in to the general country sound?
Well, at the Acme, we have somebody that programs all the music, the live music, and when there's not live music, the music that's playing. His name is Carl Gotti, and he does a great job. But we don't only have country music. There's a Thursday night where we do the Nashville Toppers, or like a funk band. We've had a reggae band playing here, a bunch of country. We've had blues, all kinds of music. And we try to use all people that are here in town and are original songwriters. And the music has really been top-notch so far. It's been really great.
Let's talk menus. Each of these restaurants in this group have different concepts, but let's focus on Acme Feed and Seed. What is the food concept here, and run us through some of your menus?
Well, as I said earlier in our conversation, the restaurants are, the concepts are different. The Acme really is kind of it's a bar. It's a honky-tonk. You know, we're right here on Broadway, and that's what it is. There's 50 of them on the street. What really sets this place apart is obviously the it's 25,000 square feet. It's very big. And, with all the floors, it's 25,000 square feet, yeah. So it's a bar, but we really have focused on food that you really can't not get in any other bar. And the food is kind of, in the original concept, Tom and I, the way we usually do it, Tom will tell me what he wants to see and what his idea is. He's a great visionary. He's got all these great, great ideas. He'll tell me what he wants to see, and then I usually chase it down and then we taste and we make some edits and we collaborate on the menu. It ended up being like street food. After we had a few conversations, I had mentioned, I said, you know, it's reading really ethnic. There's Middle Eastern food here. There's Mexican food here. There's Haitian food. There's Thai. There's regular old American Southern food. So I started pushing everything toward like street food type things. So, some of the items that I know you can't get in a bar, we have a dish called the Hatchery, which, as I said before, the third floor was, back when it was a feed store, they would hatch chicks up there. It's a pretty neat place, and I'll take you down there. It's an event space now. The Hatchery is coconut rice. We use kokuho rice, which is a Chinese medium grain rice. We cook it in coconut milk, and we have curried chickpeas. And we have some chilies and cashews and some fried eggs on top, which I know I'm pretty sure you can't get that in another bar on this strip. And there's a Haitian dish, which I don't know if you guys had my bite at the festival. It's called griot, which we take pork shoulder. Okay, great. And we braise it in lime juice and lemon juice and some habanero. Thank you. We put plantains with it, some black beans, and a sauce called timalis, which is also a habanero sauce. And it sounds really super spicy, but it's actually, it's a little spicy, but it's tart as well. And I think that dish got a great balance. We have falafel on the menu with some wheat fry bread that we make to order. The fry bread's pretty cool. Let me see what else is on the menu. We do pulled pork tacos in the style of a banh mi sandwich, you know, the famous Vietnamese sandwich, which I, that's one thing I really miss from New York is eating banh mi. So yeah, we pickled some daikon and carrots and we put cilantro and some sweet chili sauce in there and, smoked pork shoulder. Yeah, they eat a lot of pork here. That dish is great. And we do Mexican street corn. Yes, and I also miss that from New York. It's one thing I used to eat all the time at a Cafe Habana. I don't know if you ever had it there. Oh, it's so great. It's really great. Yeah, we do that with the cotija cheese and a little bit of aioli on the corn, cotija cheese and lime and some cayenne. And those are just some of the highlights. But, I mean, the menu's small, too. It's only, I think, 15 items on it.
What do they people drink here?
Well, the concept is fast casual. Well, you'll come in and you order at the cash register. They give you a cup, a plastic cup, and you, well, it's made of cornstarch, actually, no plastic. We're eco-friendly, crazy. The boss is, which is great, and we all are. You can get yourself a soda, a soft drink, and you bring a number to your table, and then there'll be a little red flag if you want an alcoholic beverage. And then we have bourbon and whiskey and 28 taps, so lots of beer, bunch of them local. And other, and a bunch of mixed drinks. They've, you know, the bar managers come up with a bunch of really cool, craft cocktails. Yeah.
And now, do you appeal to locals as well as tourists? I imagine tourists find this pretty fast, huh? But locals?
Yeah. And that's one thing that Tom Morales, really wanted to, he wanted to focus on local Nashville. The people that live in this town, because a lot of times, you know, if you're from New York, rarely would you go to Times Square unless you had people visiting. That's how I was when I lived in New York anyway. And same goes for this Broadway strip. It's a lot of honky-tonks, we call them. You know, it's music all day. Starts at 11 in the morning until 2 in the morning, 7 days a week. So live country music, usually. But Tom really wanted to kind of focus. That's why he wanted to change up the music. Don't have it only country music. A lot of tourism comes here for country music. They go to the Hall of Fame. They go to the Grand Ole Opry, which we love country music. And, I mean, I absolutely adore it. I like the old country music. But, and the food is a draw for all these business people that are here. We do a very busy lunch because all the business people that are right here in all these buildings right around us, he wanted to give them a spot where they can come down, get in and out, and go right back to work. And I forgot to mention, on floor by floor, the second floor has a little bit of a different food concept. There's a little galley. We'll be doing shareable platters, which some of the components are coming from the first floor, too. But there's also a big sushi bar, which is kind of just happened in a kind of a funny story. There was this famous guy named Sam, and he got this name, Sam the Sushi Nazi, because he was a bit of a character with no menu, and he only had, I think, 8 seats and a couple tables. And if you came in and he didn't recognize you, he'd kick you out. Or if you came in and you weren't sure what you wanted to eat, he'd kick you out. And it became this thing in Nashville where everybody wanted to go see if they could try to get a meal out of Sam. And they raised his rent, like, a lot, and he couldn't afford it and had to close shop. And he happened to come in and apply for a job when we were open this. So, excuse me, my sous chef that was helping me do the interview said, "Do you know who that is? That's Sam." I was like, "Sam who? I'm not sure who Sam is. I'm relatively new to this area." And he said, "That's Sam the sushi guy. You need to talk to him." So I talked to him. He was just applying for a line cook job. And I said, "Well, would you be interested in doing sushi? Because I figure out, this is big enough, I'll figure out a way to utilize him." And so I called Tom. I said, "Hey, what about sushi on the second floor?" And he thought it was a brilliant idea. So away we go. We have sushi on the second floor.
Yeah, well, we've known people like this. So much is going on here, Matt Farley, that I just think I'm so happy we found you. And I'm sorry you're not going to sing for us. I mean, we had, anyhow, for the record, listeners, it's Acme Feed and Seed in Nashville, and it's Chef Matt Farley, and it sounds like great fun. So be sure you hit this place if you're in Nashville, and if you're listening from Nashville, I hope you've already been here, but if not, come soon. Thanks, Matt.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
And last but by no means least in this week's program,
Deb Paquette is one of my favorite friends. She's going to be my BFF. And if we live closer, we'd hang out a lot together.
You certainly would.
Yes. And the restaurant Etch is, it was so smart and lovely.
Well, it's as modern and trendy as Acme is traditional honky tonk.
Well, we met a lot of really interesting people and had some interesting food at the Music City Food and Wine. And we're following up on some of that. We find ourselves in a very, I would say, sleekly decored, elegant and restaurant called Etch. And I'm going to ask chef owner Deb Paquette why Etch. But I noticed, and I couldn't help but notice, you have a very stylish clientele. Where are we here in Nashville?
We are in downtown Nashville off of 3rd and Demumbrian, and we decided to have a bit of an upscale restaurant because there weren't a lot of upscale restaurants in Nashville. Even though you can wear your blue jeans, all we ask is no pajamas. So in any way, we wanted to have sort of a sleek, clean look where our food is the art. And the requirement for myself to come here to work was that my employers put red heat lamps because the whole building is minimalistic with concrete and steel and wood. So here we are in Lower Las Vegas, Las Nashville, Nash Vegas.
Yeah, I've heard this reference to Las Vegas a number of times since we've been here. But why is it called Etch?
We had another name, and it fell through because it had been trademarked in another city. So I wanted to have a name that went with the name of the condominium, which is called the Encore. So we etch at the Encore. And, of course, you can take the definition of etch in a few different directions. But mainly it was I just wanted to leave a mark on your brain, in your head, in your palate that says this is a great place for you to return to. So I'm leaving my etching on you.
Now, you've been at this for a while. This is not even your first restaurant. You're not from here, I should mention, but you've been here long enough to be considered a Southern, I suppose. Except nobody ever. You're not born here, I guess. Nobody's considered so Southern. But describe a little bit about some of the experiences you've had. You've worked in hotels. You've worked in different parts of the country. Tell us a little, just a little brief synopsis of your background.
Well, I started out in my first big job out of school in a macrobiotic restaurant in New York City. Which one? Oh, yeah, where we, John Lennon could not come to the restaurant because he would be covered up with people. So he would send a runner over every day to get lunch and dinner, and they basically ate tofu and black beans and brown rice twice a day. My family was very health-oriented, so I followed suit and learned a lot about eating macrobiotic food. And it stuck with me through this day, trying to stay healthy and be able to give vegetarians a good meal and everyone. But I've been in Nashville pretty much my entire adult life, and I've worked in a few restaurants. I came here at a time when there wasn't it was not a food city. It was more about insurance and the Bible Belt, printing, hospitalization. So it has taken time for different industries to come this way, for the Food Network, for a lot of people to recognize that, yeah, we do have some good food, and we do have some good chefs, and we do not all cook Southern traditional food. We do have our Meat and Three restaurants, and there are plenty of them, and they're damn good. But I wanted to always do something a little bit on the edge. And so I bring into my restaurant more food from around the world. You know, I don't totally do it. It's a bastardization of Moroccan food or Turkish food or Syrian food. So we just get to have fun. I teach the kids here how to use aromatic spices and how to win over the public's taste buds. My mantra is to cook for people what they can't cook at home. So I've taken myself on a book tour of my living room with every cookbook, about 500 of them I have, filling my brain over the years with information from great authors and great chefs and great scientists to have this great restaurant here. And I bring it all together with a great staff. So we're having fun here, and we're doing great, and we love being downtown.
Well, I mean, I'm going to jump in here and say that I thought, and Peter and I talked about this, we both agreed that in terms of general food festivals and dine around, the level of food that we had on Saturday afternoon, Saturday night, and Sunday afternoon was really at the top A-list all the way. So I think you're about to bounce big onto the scene here, and your restaurant looks like it's positioned to be right there. Tell me about being a female chef in Nashville.
Well, it means you have to have different body parts than the men. That's one thing that makes us different. I would say, you know, women have a different disposition. They have a different kind of common sense. They have a different quest. And I think they are really made to be leaders in the kitchens. They're a calming sort, and we get treated like we're moms. And actually, they call me mom. Some call me mama. I'm sure some of them call me some things I don't know yet and maybe don't ever want to know. But you're on top of your game, and your ego is just, it doesn't need as much petting as a man's ego, I'd say, wouldn't you? Anyway, but it's good. I've had some ups and downs with men coming up in this business because I'm 58 years old, and I have been through the times of where women weren't at the top of their game in this field. So I have had some situations occur that were maddening and frustrating, but I didn't make a big deal about it. I got through it, and here I am today running a great restaurant. And I know plenty of other women chefs in the city, and they do a fabulous job of it, and they have great communication skills. Not that men don't. It's just that we're women.
Let's talk a little bit about specifics on your menus, because our listeners really get into descriptions and the food porn, you know, in specifics. Somebody told me, absolutely, that you were very famous for your cauliflower. Is that true?
It's an appetizer that I used to fix at my home, and I thought, I'm going to try this and see if it works. So we make a smoked green pea pesto on one side of the plate, and on the other side of the plate is a cauliflower feta cream, and then we have a little bit of a roasted red pepper spicy drizzle on it, and we just roast the cauliflower in a convection oven, which makes it quick and browns it nicely, and then we sprinkle a little truffle oil over it when it's served. It's sort of one of those things that appeases the palate wonderfully. The essence of smoke in the peas, the truffle oil, the saltiness of the feta, and the crunch of it. So it kind of like makes a complete circle when you're eating it. And we're surprised at how many people like it, and we're so excited that we have gotten people to eat cauliflower who would never eat it before. And we also give $1 of every sale of cauliflower to the Second Harvest Food Bank. So the end of the year, we will probably contribute somewhere between $14,000 and $15,000.
Wow. Oh, Deb, you never cease to amaze me. I'll tell you, I'm so pleased to have met you. Can you pick out a couple of other stars from your menu and talk about them?
I would say the dinner menu, we have a sustainable farm-raised cobia, and it's got some Turkish spice on it, so it's kind of... It's got some heat and some acridness to it, but it's balanced with an orange juice sauce made with white balsamic that has capers and olives and golden raisins in it, and you have to cook it down with brown butter, and then we serve it on a potato beignet, and it's kind of like a surprise, but it's a great surprise, and it's not overly sweet because of the vinegar and the brine from all the other things in it. And we finish it off with a little bit of feta and roasted almonds and spicy harissa cranberries. So it's kind of a lot of fun things going on. Now, it is too much for some, but most people who are into food and love big flavors love it. And so when I changed the menu last year, I could not take it off because people said they would stop coming in. So I have left it on there, and we'll see. It could be there next year. It could be there the next year, but... we'll see what happens, but it's a big hit. That and our filet are our two biggest sellers.
You have Vietnamese shrimp French roll. Tell us about that. Sounds really yum.
Well, it's a takeoff on the banh mi sandwich, but we made it vegetarian, and we take black beans and make a black bean paste with hoisin. And we put some shredded pickled daikon on it. We put pickled ginger. We put some Korean spice shrimp on it. And, of course, you have to have mayonnaise. It's a must. And fresh mint and fresh cilantro. My mom was in the other day. She had it. She just loved it. And we put it on one of those hoagie rolls. It's crispy on the outside and soft on the inside. And it's a lot of fun, and you can have it vegetarian, just leaving the shrimp off. So we try to do that on our menu where we can have a lot of crossing over and make anything gluten-free or make it vegan or vegetarian to accommodate all those people out there who have those kind of needs.
It's getting on more. I was drawn to your dessert menu by one what I would consider totally over-the-top luxury. Your chocolate pretzel bar.
Yes, my lovely pastry chef, Megan Williams, who's on her vacation right now. It's fabulous. It is wicked, wicked rich. It's a diabetic coma waiting to happen. But it does have this pretzel crust that's salty and then a layer of ganache and then this mousse, and it's decadent. It's very decadent. I love the crust. Like when she makes the pretzel crust, I just eat it like it's cookies. I can leave some of that chocolate off, though. Too much of it makes me spin circles, along with, as most chefs drink way too much coffee. So I try to drink coffee and stay away from the chocolate.
And you're not shy in your libations here. You have a great variety of these and also very extensive a wine and drinks list. So that's an important part of your program?
Oh, of course. I mean, you know, it's the biggest part of our program. Alcohol brings great profits to the bottom line. But it's also the whole craft cocktail concept is huge, and we do have, I think, about 10. We don't have a lot. Our bar's not real big, but they're pretty darn yummy. We have one that has a little bit of cayenne with tequila and a simple syrup and has cilantro in it, and it's killer. It's killer. I love it. And some lime. And then our wine list is very accessible and safe, and we try to make sure that over half the wines on the menu do go with the food. And it can be quite tricky because I have some big, bold flavors, and some things can be hard to pair with, but I have a great manager and sommelier, and they work diligently at it. And, you know, they ask me to taste, and I make sure that they eat the food so they can work on that project.
For details about the restaurant, we suggest you go to www.etchrestaurant.com. And I'm just thrilled that we're going to be eating here, Deb. And also, I'm just thrilled to death to meet you because you're a trooper and yes, and you know the ropes.
Yes, you have to know the ropes. In fact, I have some to swing on in the back room.
Free time.
And it's a great opportunity to be talking with both of you today, and I appreciate you setting me aside and having a great conversation. Thank you.
And we'll have more from Music City, USA, same time, same place next week, so don't forget to join us then. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.